we have a new show at Turpentine that's been in the works for a long time, Company Breakdowns. We dive into S1s and Series B and beyond companies, interviewing founders and investors to break down the companies. First episode is on Rubrik, which IPO'd this week. Upcoming episodes cover Reddit, Databricks, and more. Subscribe at the link in the description or search for Company Breakdowns on YouTube or in the podcast platform of your choice. Welcome to Live Players, where political scientists and strategists Sam Oberia and I discuss the key individuals with the power to alter our current society. Every week, we provide analysis of the news and case studies of live players, as well as key institutions and technologies that make up the global power landscape. Let's dive in.
Our last episode, we talked about Xi Jinping and the power base in China at the moment. We also alluded to sort of that we wanted to talk more about what China is doing in things like space and quantum and other sort of technological areas. So why don't you give a broad overview and then we'll get into the specifics.
I think the most important thing to understand about China's pursuit of some of these technologies is that they perceive them to have both an economic value and a key strategic value. So it's not just that these are technologies that are aimed at developing a general military capacity. They're trying to develop a few specific capabilities. It's pretty self-explanatory why breakthroughs in quantum technology would basically change the algorithmic underpinnings of everything in our society. It would basically create a whole new type of processor, a whole new type of compute hardware, and perhaps completely new paradigms of communication as well. For other branches, though, the immediate effect of new computational advancements might be the breaking of great chunks of the world's encryption. I'm sure there will be some clever countermeasures, and I'm sure we will figure out new ways to encrypt things. But if you've ever observed how large institutions buy software, use software, and so on, buy technology, it'll take a while to even have the secure channels of, say, the United States government be once more secure in such a scenario. Of course, an observer might immediately point out that, wait, China's encryption will also be immediately obsolete. But the difference here is that most of us assume that the NSA can basically break most aspects of Chinese communication already. It doesn't matter if point B to C is mathematically provably encrypted, if the machine A to B is already compromised. And there's extensive evidence for that capability. To some extent, this also then undercuts the previous argument. A lot of the hardware, which was made in China and used internationally, such as technology by Huawei and so on, concerns have been raised that the very hardware itself is sort of intentionally compromised and basically has backdoors installed. So this is a very multi-level game. However, few things would benefit China more than a transition to a completely new paradigm of computing, especially if they were on basically equal footing with the United States. There would be massive possibility for investment by Chinese companies. Anything that is a state strategic priority basically gets like mass deregulated, which is interestingly the opposite of what happens in the United States. If something becomes the priority of Congress or the president, it gets regulated. And it's very uncommon to have the opposite happen. There's an argument to be made that fracking and allowing fracking was almost this geopolitical decision after the early 2000s. But the connection there is very tenuous, right? It might have just happened as a fortunate oversight that radically improved U.S. energy production. Meanwhile, for China, in theory, they have a lot of red tape. It just all gets suspended whenever that red tape gets in the way of meeting a growth target or a technological target. Now, to talk a little bit about space, well, why space is dual use, that's something that I think everyone knows. There's a reason that in the 1950s, the United States panicked after Sputnik, the so-called Sputnik moment, because if you can bring a small satellite into orbit, you can bring a small payload anywhere on the planet. This has been understood since the dawn of ICBM technology. There are, however, also other less obvious uses for cheaper payloads to orbit. Anything that can bring a commercial satellite to orbit can cheaply also bring a military satellite to orbit. These can be either spy satellites or they can be military satellites. Since the early 2000s, China has concerned the Western world through tests of satellite weaponry, where you have anti-satellite satellites, right? This is this goes against treaties that date back to the Cold War that were admittedly primarily signed by the United States and the Soviet Union to limit satellite weaponry. The view tended to be that satellite weaponry would inevitably lead to the orbital deployment of nuclear warheads. And I don't know, like I think it's pretty clear why that would be concerning. If you imagine like an H-bomb in a dated satellite in a decaying orbit, you know, maybe it just burns up harmlessly, spewing some radiation, or, you know, maybe some of the mechanisms on that old thing would misfire. Like, even if we trust the technology of today, you know, these things would probably just be up in orbit until someone went and collected them. So it was a very reasonable strategic arms limitation move. There is also then the question of intercepting ballistic missiles. So the capabilities here are not just like, you know, espionage in the form of satellites, delivery of payloads on a greater scale. It is also the interception and intercept capabilities. The economic aspect of a private space industry is now apparent in the Western world, with the United States leading the charge for the last decade, greatly undercutting the satellite launch prices for everything from, you know, weather satellites to communication satellites to GPS satellites that, you know, help us all navigate. They've greatly undercut the Japanese space agency. They've greatly undercut anything that can be provided by Europe's Ariane rockets. And they also, of course, greatly undercut Russia, which, while an early leader in the field, has failed to reduce its once unbeatable launch costs. And note the launch costs, the low Russian launch costs in the early 2000s, were something that it was assumed the United States and Europe could not compete with for a variety of reasons, right? Like how costly is the infrastructure, how proven the designs, and so on. SpaceX demonstrated this is a viable business and in fact can grow very large and at least with some vision and guidance can even to some extent as a commercial industry determine its future regardless of the military priorities that sort of drew and drove the first American space race. Their private satellite launch companies operating in China and the contractor ecosystem in the institutional ecosystem of both the Chinese space program and also their space military program has been expanding to include more and more private companies, some of who just do business with other parts of the Chinese civilian sector without any oversight. These launch costs are, of course, higher than SpaceX, but they are, among all of the world's possible competitors to SpaceX, the most cost efficient. They have been bringing consistently their costs of launch down. So perhaps like, you know, at this point, it's good to consider that these are also proving grounds for the quality of Chinese engineering and the quality of Chinese scientific contributions. China has a broad understanding that their academic system is more prone to scientific and scholarly fraud and low quality than the Western one. While it has grown immensely in prestige and while it attracts and keeps more of the talent inside the country, something like quantum technology, right, requires you to basically get this cutting edge stuff, like stuff that is not yet proceduralized, stuff that's there's nothing to copy from the Western world. So if it can fund and build these advancements, if that proves to be the case, then they are a co-creator, not just of our manufacturing or technological future, they're a co-creator of our scientific future, since they are, I think, to a great extent, some unsolved problems in computer science and physics that could greatly contribute to the development of that technology in particular. And for rockets, of course, well, quality control. A market that has demanding customers, like a space industry, often sets the bar, sets a gold standard, where it's just actually cheaper to comply with the gold standard for all of your materials, right? Even if it's just 20% of your revenue, it might actually make sense that because 20% of your revenue needs to be like, you know, if I joke, space grade steel, maybe it's then just cheaper to sell 100% of your steel as space grade steel, right? Not everything is like that, but some things are, and there's a real training effect on the high end of the kind of components you can get around the world if there is a very advanced and well-developed industry or application that demands those high-quality materials, that high level of accuracy, and so on.
Hey, everybody. Eric here with a word from our sponsors. Over 100 startups launched today. Do you know who they are? If you're not seeing interesting startups, none of your downstream processes matter. How you source deals at the earliest stages could be your most consequential investment. Harmonic is the most complete startup database, finding new companies as soon as they incorporate and tracking them through IPO. You can create a search tailored to your investment thesis. In one search, filter over company data, including venture stage, industry, and geography, founders and operators' backgrounds, and traction metrics like headcount changes, social media audience, and web traffic growth. Importantly, Harmonic instantly surfaces warm connections to help you connect with founders. The results are delivered on autopilot, wherever you most need them. Over Slack, email, or via API, directly into your CRM, integrating seamlessly into your software stack. Learn why Kraft, Bedrock, NEA, and hundreds more trust Harmonic's data by visiting harmonic.ai or use the link in the description. Make sure you mention our podcast, Turpentine VC, during your demo.
And so that's a great overview or introduction. Say more about kind of the biggest implications of sort of everything you've said put together in terms of what this means for China relative to you know, how it's perceived or sort of vis-a-vis US, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What are the things we should take away here?
Yeah, I mean, the most interesting thing about this is that China has successfully picked up, for example, the Russian space base, Russian technological base, their first manned rocket, if listeners and viewers go look up, you know, the first manned Chinese flight into space, they look at that rocket and then they look at the Soyuz rocket right next to it and they look at the vehicle there, right? They'll notice that it's clearly the same technology. So the Chinese just bought it, reverse engineered it, made it somewhat better. And the interesting thing is that they are developing it further. They have developed it beyond what the Russians have been able to do with it. So I think this once again shows that it's not just copying, there's incremental progress. And I think to many people in the Western world, we might not even understand how quickly China has caught up to basically the frontier of our achievements in space. We might even be in for a great status shock, right? The first, you know, the first Chinese, you know, astronaut, if we say, they, you know, they have their own word like cosmonaut or whatever, but I just think that's silly. I think we should just call all of them astronauts. There's no need to have these unique words. But the first manned flight of, you know, a man to orbit, a human being to orbit, was 2003. That's less than 21 years ago. Since then, they've constructed a fully operating space station, the Tiangong space station. The International Space Station, which is a well-known effort that we're all familiar with, that, you know, began construction basically. The components were being built even sometimes in the 1980s before being repurposed in the 1990s. Designs were on the drawing board then. The International Space Station does not have Chinese participation. It has Russian participation, Western participation, India, you know, Canada, and so on. The U.S. blocked the Chinese addition or entry to the International Space Station, because they did not want a technology transfer in these crucial technologies. So the Chinese just built their own, in addition to, of course, basically buying from the Russians everything the Russians have. And the Chinese space station, the Tiangong space station, has a crew, which crew maximum is about 7 people. Currently, there are 3 in orbit. And this doesn't feature much in our awareness. It means that they are, in fact, studying and building the capability to survive long periods of time in low Earth orbit, how to keep life support up, how to keep your astronauts safe, and so on. It also means any sort of industrial, technological space research that we might have begun to experiment with, such as zero-G manufacturing, is something that China can do as well, and of course, various biological experiments. Add to this, then, the speed of the Chinese lunar exploration program, which, you know, I think we've almost grown tired or don't notice how often we hear of various Chinese robotic landers making their way to the moon, right? Basically, you know, the first landing, I think, was something like 2013. And then there was another one in 2018. And then in 2019, there was a South Pole landing on the far side of the moon, which was sort of like, you know, the first landing on that side of the moon. The difficulty of that maneuver is that, of course, communication is blocked from Earth unless you had like your own constellation of satellites, right? One side of the moon faces the Earth always. The other side faces away. Radio signals can't really travel. Radio or laser signals can't really travel through the moon. So you're out of communication for that period. So that's what's impressive about landing a robotics probe there. I'm going to point out the only two times in history where countries have landed this many robotic probes on the moon is when they were seriously planning and making progress towards putting a human being on the moon. The Lunokhod missions of the Soviet Union were only really run while they were considering putting people there. The same is true of the Surveyor probes. So adding this together, dropping launch costs, an interest in national prestige, ability to maintain life support systems, and ability to do soft landings on the moon's surface. Well, I think that at some point, they're going to press the button and they will try to bring Chinese taikonauts to the moon, right? And if that happens, can you imagine the psychological impact on the world, the propaganda value of the world? Like seeing, you know, the red, kind of the red Chinese flag on the moon. Maybe they even have HD video. Maybe they stream it on TikTok everywhere. Maybe more people see that actually than the original moon landing, which to this day remains the largest televised event ever, because while we have videos that many more people have seen, it's never been the case that a single event happening in real lifetime has been seen by many more people than the number that saw the original moon landing. You might very well beat that record just because now, you know, not all of the planet had television sets in 1969, and we're getting awfully close to everyone on the planet having a smartphone in the 2020s, let's say. Or if they achieve this in the early 2030s, it's almost certain that over 90% of people would have a smartphone, 90% of people alive in the world. Now, the US has plans that they set, which suggests that they might return to the moon sooner than the Chinese, right? The Artemis missions. The problem with this is that these targets have been already pushed back many times over. The first crewed mission, so the mission that has a crew that is planned to go around the moon, is planned for 2025. This is like a little over a year from now. I'm very dubious that that's going to happen. And then 2026 is going to land the first astronaut near the lunar South Pole. I'm also willing to bet against that date. And the reason is, in the Western world, dates are often fundraising targets. And the unique thing about the Chinese space program is that while it continues to be significantly state-led, with, again, support of those privatized companies that I mentioned, which have achieved notable results, right? They've brought down launch costs significantly. And, you know, they have very fun names like the China Great Wall Industry Corporation. I kid you not, that's what it's called. Provides medium lift satellite launches as a service, and it prices them at around $70 million per launch. You know, we can compare this to the SpaceX Falcon 9, which is at around $62 million per launch, or the old Russian Proton rockets, which were about, you know, $65 million before the Falcon 9 beat them. Starship is going to be even better, but Starship is still in its development cycle, of course, and there is only limited demand for such a significant lift capacity. One of the few things you might want to lift 100 tons of material into orbit is precisely a moon mission. We might find ourselves, to everyone's surprise, in the late 2020s in a real live moon race, right? A space race once again for the same prize that the Soviet Union and the United States competed over. It's been so long that this type of development would have an immense shock on the Western world. But it is also precisely the kind of thing which, while in the big picture, it might even backfire. I mean, I certainly believe it would make efforts to get to Mars much more serious, right? If China beats America to the moon, how much political capital can you mint by declaring, well, we got to the moon first, and we're going to get to Mars first as well, right? They're not going to beat us to Mars. That sort of thing, I feel, would happen. Maybe it wouldn't be done super well, but it would happen, and the U.S. would still have some advantage. Probably, again, precisely because of SpaceX. However, within China, they would see this as a crowning moment of equality with the United States. The current thrust of Chinese nationalism is this desire to return to a more central position in the world. Now, of course, space is not just symbolic. I talked a lot about the moon because I enjoyed the history of space exploration. And I think, again, the propaganda impact of achieving something that so far has only been achieved by the United States would be very significant, right? Can you imagine Chinese tourists on the moon, like, you know, visiting the Apollo 11 landing site? Like tranquility-based tourism, right? That would be pretty funny. It's a plausible future a few decades from now. So that sort of achievement is a big deal in geopolitical symbolism. It's a big deal ideologically. But the very real deployment of space weaponry is also something that the US and other countries have escalated more and more. They have invested more and more into these technologies.
How would you sort of pie chart the sort of like the reasons for why it's important to be advanced here for a superpower, aspiring superpower? Is a lot of it sort of the political capital or sort of geopolitical posturing that is you know, has real value, or the symbolism you talk about, or is that is that overstated? How should we think about the relative importance versus that versus the more practical benefits for us, for a country?
I think manned flight is currently all symbolic, but symbolism has this important value of providing public justification for the development of dual-use technology. If you develop, say, a civilian space station, you have developed most of the technology that you need for a military space station. And in fact, the Soviet Union did this with the Salyut space stations having a brother military space station. And, you know, even the space shuttle, when it was originally developed, had plans for variants of it to be ordered by the U.S. military, because it might want to bring a payload to orbit and then bring it back. Later, one of the few reusable vehicles that the United States has developed that basically uses this kind of space plane design is currently in use. And it's, of course, like, you know, an automated vehicle. It's not the long retired space shuttle. I think it's operated by the US Air Force. So, you know, those sorts of ideas were not completely without merit. It's just you don't really need to put astronauts on that type of vehicle. Reducing the cost of launch to orbit, though, like I mentioned, for medium-sized lifts, the importance of that is that, honestly, the better you are at scaling your rocket technology, the cheaper your ICBMs are and the better they'll be. Also, having the best network of satellites means you have the best communication and the best, you know, the best maps of the Earth's surface that are perhaps even updated live. So you do the best, you know, aerial reconnaissance, right, has been basically obsoleted to a great extent by satellite reconnaissance. Systems like GPS, until quite recently, were very limited for civilian applications compared to military applications. GPS is an American-controlled satellite network. Of course, there's a Russian competitor that's much worse because they have many fewer satellites. And there is a Chinese effort to build it. Finally, then, the one thing where it might make sense to bring hundreds of tons of material into orbit is once again something SpaceX is doing, blanketing the sky in low-flying satellites. The lower a satellite flies, the more atmospheric drag it experiences, the faster it needs replacing. However, the closer it is to the Earth's surface, the less lag it experiences, which is very important for Starlink. China does have the funding that it could possibly just build its own Starlink if it could bring the launch costs cheap enough. And then we're not just talking about communications or surveillance. We are actually talking about the backbone of the internet. If you can link up to Starlink from a phone or a laptop, it's the equivalent of covering the planet in Wi-Fi, right? You could think of it as satellite Wi-Fi. It would obsolete the undersea cable infrastructure. And most importantly, if a rival power provides the service, I think the US would have a very difficult time figuring out how to subsidize its own alternative. And they would find themselves in a position where they have to pay something that is not subsidized by everyone on the planet. Right? You would just have to support it for your military. Now, fortunately, I think SpaceX is ahead. However, I think this demonstrates that the economic returns and the information returns of the space industry might be more important than ever. So it's not just, can we have the best ICBMs and can we make them cheap and can we make our military satellites cheap because their launch costs are low? It might literally be also, do we provide global communications infrastructure, right? And like, how much would China pay to provide global communications infrastructure, right? I think the answer is quite a bit.
Yeah. And one thing that you've written about in your brief is how it's not just that it's all been sort of state-controlled enterprise. We alluded to a little bit here, but say more, like in the US, you know, without Elon, it feels like, you know, the traction that we would have in the industry would be, you know, orders of magnitude less. Whereas in China, sort of driven by the state, but now it sort of has a sort of dual, you know, multiple private players. Why don't you talk about that kind of balance in the US as it relates to China between sort of the public and private?
Basically, in 2014, the Chinese government started to intentionally develop its privatized space sector. Before this, they basically ran things in a way that could be considered analogous to NASA or any of these other state-run efforts. I already mentioned, the Great Wall Industry Corporation, which I have to imagine this is like something like the Bald Eagle Corporation. Like that sounds like, from the outside, among the most patriotic company names you can come up with. And you only brand yourself hyper-patriotic if you're trying to sell to customers that really care about it. So I think the adjacency to the Chinese state and, the Chinese military is still clear, but this new generation of private companies has started growing since then. They're in the process of maturing. They're no giants yet, like, you know, SpaceX, but the private companies are filling these expanding orders by the state, but also by Chinese industry, right? The key question here, in my mind, is will any of these become internationally competitive? Unlike many other areas where I'm quite bullish on the competitiveness of cutting edge Chinese industry, I actually don't think that they will easily become as competitive. I think this is a case where everything's moving fast for for the bureaucracy, but the US is actually just faster. And it is mostly SpaceX. If it was a competition, let's say, of Blue Origin versus China, I would still sort of believe Blue Origin could do a better job than China. I would still believe that. But if it was neither for Blue Origin or SpaceX, I think that these companies, such as, you know, things like LandSpace, is a Chinese company, these would become mature. Like, to give some examples, right? The founders in the Chinese commercial space sector receive venture capital. Like, LandSpace is funded by Chinese venture capitalists. And, you know, the founder of the company, Zhang, he knew them through his previous career in finance. Isn't that interesting? Why are the founders of Chinese space companies coming in from finance and software? Well, it sort of feels the same as in the Western world, right? And I think this shows how closely they're trying to follow some of these models. It is true, though, that this company was co-founded by two senior engineers from the state-owned enterprises. And the interesting thing here, again, is that those engineers were allowed to leave the company. Now, basically, this LandSpace company is just a private launcher, right? And they are trying to target SpaceX style achievement. And the Chinese government favors that. It's just that they don't have any means to make that happen. I think they actually would need an Elon for that. And I don't think they have an Elon tier person ready to focus their energy into space. And even if they did, this would be a sector that is even more controlled, right, internationally than the kind of exports that Huawei produces. I think it's closer in nature to exporting nuclear reactors, right, where you have these big companies that often do a lot of business with governments. So if you want to launch, say, as the United Arab Emirates, you want to launch a satellite, and you don't want to use the Russians, well, you better be on good terms with the United States or Japan or some country that has these providers. I think it's something that's actually, like, fairly easy to sanction. It would be fairly easy to say, okay, no Western company may buy a satellite launch on a Chinese-based company. And the argument, the national security argument, can be made very quickly and easily.
We've talked about in other episodes sort of China's natural constraints around demographics, around, sort of the challenges with energy, food. And it seems like a lot of their hopes are via technological innovation and advancement to even just sustain itself sustaining its growth. To what extent do you think they're focused on the right things or allocating capital and manpower and time in the right ways versus misguide or not focusing enough or focusing too much on certain things?
I think that to a very great extent, they are copying Western priorities when it comes to fundamental scientific breakthroughs. To give an example, in 2008, the U.S. Congress passed the National Quantum Initiative Act, which, established a White House office. It gave the field an R&D budget of $1.2 billion over 5 years, and so on and so on. This almost immediately made it into China's 14th five-year plan. And they basically tried to match U.S. spending. So on quantum, at least, they try to match U.S. spending. And they basically spend resources on all the same things that the West finds interesting, right? So they might go into gene editing if they see an argument that Western governments are spending money on that. They might go into quantum. They might go into fusion power and so on. The areas where their technological development targets their concrete problems are fairly limited. I think that this mostly happens in places where, in fields where there is incremental progress that has been demonstrated elsewhere. Say they will look at the statistics on automation, right? The Chinese, like decision makers, will look at the statistics on automation use in Germany and Japan. And they will correctly point out that, look, they have high labor costs and they have a aging population. And look, one of the ways in which they keep themselves competitive is through high uses of automation. China then tries to do the same thing. But they are nowhere near as creative as, say, a government like Singapore, right? Where they will pursue a novel technological field rather than, you know, try to catch up to this or that Western country, to pursue a novel technological field in order to solve a fundamental Chinese problem. I think that politically is nowhere in their discourse. You could maybe claim that artificial intelligence is the first one, but I would say it's not. You know, when the Singaporean government has a sovereign wealth fund that invests into insect protein corporations around the world because they understand that insect protein is like kind of what you would need to have that tiny city state with no land feed its population. Okay, that's science fiction thinking. That's like actual technology and science driven problem solving, whatever one thinks of insect protein. When the Chinese government says we're going to invest in AI, I think it's much more similar to them following the lead of the investment of Western governments. The main argument is sort of like, you know, Mr. Chairman, we cannot allow an AI gap. Look at all of these American companies. Look at all the AI stuff that they're doing. Look at all of this money that Western universities have to play around with this. And now Western companies have to play around with this. We have to make this a state mandated effort. So the question of, like, do you pick a field of scientific investigation to try to solve a big problem in your society, or do you just fund what all the other societies with very different problems are pursuing? This conceptually is a big difference. I would argue they can make scientific, they can make technological advancements. They can make some scientific advancements, but the jury's out at how good they are. They do not currently plan well on how to pursue the kind of scientific advancements that solve their society's problems. And here, actually, I would say that at least potentially, the Western world has a great advantage. It's not because of some foresight of Western governments. At the end of the day, U.S. Congress was persuaded about the potential of quantum technology, partially because China was already funding it. So you could think of it as kind of a science arms race, where neither decision maker has a deep, you know, a deep model of how human society would be transformed. Rather, sufficiently a promising development, in my opinion, is that many of the more prominent venture capitalists who are relatively politically independent, very science fiction literate, and I do mean science fiction literate with the imagining of alternate futures, have reoriented towards using basically software fortunes to solve hardware problems and sometimes even borderline scientific problems. If you look at Helion, they actually are at least claiming to, if you read their material, figuring out things at the frontier of science, not just of engineering, that there are some different phenomena that they observe experimentally than what was predicted by theoretical models before these machines were built, right? Before their fusion reactor prototypes were built. That is super interesting, right? Like when I read that, it piqued my attention. The more fundamental spending on anti-aging research, on various other kinds of bioscience that also is now private sector funding. It's very hard to get a politician or even a statesman deeply interested in the future. I think you can kind of get quirky civil servants to be really interested in how technology transforms the world. And you can get, you know, independently wealthy people who are let's say, mildly ideologically transhumanist to do that as well. So in the US, that would be the aforementioned venture capitalists, and it would be, you know, some of the civil servants in DARPA who are imagining how to transform the US. Of course, their mandate is a narrow defense mandate. It's sort of like, how do we transform the military sector, right? Which still has a competitive and political logic. We'll see if in the future, you know, Chinese entrepreneurs are allowed to be as ambitious as US entrepreneurs can be, and if their venture capitalists are allowed to spend funds on, you know, projects that might transform Chinese society. I think both of those have, in the last 15 years, been cracked down on. Jack Ma seems to have been like the high watermark of how much impact on Chinese society can a purely commercial or technocratic actor that's not aligned with the CCP have. I think, and the ceiling is like pretty low. It's sort of like critiquing their financial regulations. It won't go all the way to like funding human cloning or like trying to live forever. If a Chinese billionaire attempted, let's say, the Brian Johnson brand, I think they would be very quickly re-educated.
Because of the sort of repulsion to it, because of the fears of the sort of or say more about what would happen.
Well, I think they would inevitably have to start talking about lifespan and health advice, and they would very quickly become perhaps even ironically a very popular figure in China. I think life extension is way less taboo in China than it is in the Western world. I think they really like the idea of living longer. But ironically, a Chinese Brian Johnson might be super popular, but that's precisely what would make them threatening. Excessive popularity while setting a bad example, the key optics that it would inspire is that it's inequality, right? Inequality is like, you know, in the West, I think we're too sensitive for certain kinds of inequality, right? We should, I think, assume that if a technology is developed to extend the life of the very rich, it eventually will be become cheaper and cheaper, and we will try, all of us, to make it cheaper, and then eventually all of us will live fairly long. But I think in China, the gap in medical care is still so significant, right? Like, private medical care vastly outstrips what's publicly available. And because their society values health and values longevity, they would be more sensitive to this perceived inequality of, look at this capitalist, right, living forever. So I think the better mode in China would be a private clinic outside of Beijing where senior Chinese Communist Party officials can get their rejuvenation treatments. I think that's probably the better way to run a company. Now, whether it's scientifically effective or not, I don't know. I'm just pointing out that it has to be sort of aligned with the interests of those people. And in the United States, by the way, no one would ever want to have an anti-aging company headquartered next to the U.S. Congress, even though U.S. Congress is probably older than the Chinese Politburo on average at this point. It's like a totally different political economy. It's totally different considerations. Yeah. The congressmen would be like less open to weird experimental stuff. They'd be open to high-end stuff, which they're using right now, but they wouldn't get the stem cell transfusions or whatever.
Yeah. Side note, it is pretty fascinating how big Brian Johnson has gotten in a very short period of time, just a couple of years, it seems. It speaks that this opportunity for someone to become this sort of figure representing sort of the rich person who does anything to extend their lifespan was just waiting for someone to seize that opportunity. And it begs the question, what are other opportunities that are just waiting for the right entrepreneur / cultural figure to just own that sort of conversation and take it forward into the zeitgeist?
I mean, all of us are so used to Elon now that we forget how crazy it was that a billionaire came in and owned the discourse on space, and then came in and owned the discourse on electric cars. I think, and I honestly wish, more billionaires just owned an area of progress that they personally specialized in. And then you don't even have to fight the other billionaires that much or fight the the government or whatever, and you don't need to pay huge NGOs. No, you're just personally really dedicated. You have your sometimes crackpot ideas for it, and you write very large checks and you manage large organizations to like do what you want them to do directly. I honestly think that's a better form of retirement than the super yachts. But for some reason, you know, our society has, until these two recent examples, almost like admired the super yacht owners more, right? And I think the reason is because it's so boring that they're not memorable, and it was bad to stand out. It's even worse to stand out in China, of course, as a very rich person. But even in the Western world, we're on the same spectrum. We're a bit more tolerant in the United States, especially, of these idiosyncratic personalities. Even though I actually think that these brands, you know, they do a lot of, they do very, very good things for technological project and societal development. But maybe to like turn back to, will China use science to solve its fundamental problems? The answer is no, because I think their leaders just don't read good science fiction. So if I was Xi Jinping and I wanted to change this tomorrow, it would be kind of cringe, but I would pick 10 good science fiction books and tell everyone, look, for the next party congress where we set the next 5-year plan, I'm going to need every single person in the Congress to read these 10 science fiction books. And then you're going to be quizzed to see if you read them. And then I want to hear science fiction style ideas for what the next 5-year plan would be. That would actually make China kind of the country of the future. But that's not going to happen. Not even in China, right? We discussed in previous episodes how, even though I'm sure there are some quirky engineers there, right, who, you know, want to spend, you know, spend on science fiction initiatives, I think they're the equivalent of the, what is it, Newt Gingrich, I think, sponsored like moon initiatives and other cool science stuff. And he was kind of exceptional for a US representative. I think it's like that in China too. And a lot of the people in China who are trained as engineers are people who, if they were in a wealthier society, wouldn't have necessarily chosen to become engineers. It was just the job that seemed promising in a relatively underdeveloped country. These would be like agricultural engineers or steel or whatever, or chemicals, which is honestly fine. And, you know, does give you some scientific grounding. For looking for like true countries of the future, I think neither the United States nor China are actually great models of that. I think the closest we have had to like a science fiction government is probably Singapore itself, because of the large investments coupled with technocratic literacy, right? With technological literacy. You can have people who both write a government check, write a government policy, and kind of understand the science at play. And, you know, I think sort of maybe the United Kingdom was that back in the 1940s. It's good to remember just the speed of breakthroughs that they were producing during wartime, right? Like radar, computers, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that in the rest of the world, scientific spending is driven by consensus, either the consensus of experts in a field or the consensus of governments. All of the green energy spending in Europe just amounts to cutting a check and writing a check that is ultimately spent on stuff built in China, right? So, and it's always spent on super conventional things that everyone finds an objectionable. So I think that a futurist government, to have a truly futurist government, would also be necessarily accepting a, at times, somewhat capricious government, and at times a government that changes their mind a lot. And you know, while no one really wants a capricious, powerful government, I think honestly at this point, a government that changes its mind and changes its policies rapidly would be refreshing.
Well said. I'm tempted to want to get into some of the defense stuff more, but I think we can leave that for another episode. You have a whole brief on how that's really interesting. Is there anything on what we've been talking about today that we haven't yet discussed or that we should make sure to mention before we leave, or any wrapping thoughts?
I think that, you know, when it comes to the frontier of technology, you know, live players almost by definition have a strong advantage. And when it comes to the funding models embraced in China in the United States, there are a variety of very interesting life players. Pan Jianwei is interesting because he's integrated both personally in the Communist Party hierarchy and the scientific hierarchy. He personally could coordinate with Xi Jinping to accomplish various goals. And I think this sort of like person that has one foot in the scientific world and one foot in the political world, they could potentially lead to some surprising breakthroughs from China. But their strongest argument is going to stay limited to, hey, let us pursue a unique breakthrough in a field that the United States is already a leader in. They're never going to be able to convince party leadership to open up to totally new fields.
That's a great place to wrap as we continue our China series. Samo, as always, great discussion. And until next time.
Till next time.
Thanks for listening to Live Players. Please subscribe, leave a review, and check out Samo's excellent newsletter, The Bismarck Brief, for more rigorous analysis of key individuals, institutions, or industries. Live Players is a production of Turpentine, the podcast network behind Econ 102 with Noah Smith and Moment of Zen. Hey everyone, Eric here. At Turpentine, we're building the first media outlet for tech people by tech people. We're the network behind the show you're listening to right now. We have a slate of hit shows across a range of topics and industries, from our AI and investing cluster of podcasts, to shows that drive the conversation in tech with the most interesting thinkers, founders, investors, and influencers, like Econ 102 with Noah Smith. We're launching new shows every week, and we're looking for industry-leading sponsors. If you think that might be you and your company, email me at ericaturpentine.co. That's E-R-I-K at turpentine.co, and let's partner together.